I was in Korea maybe almost 50 years ago.
50?
I was a U.S. Army reporter.
Oh, that's what it was. Wow.
Yeah. So that's my connection with Korea.
It's changed so much.
Oh,
there's
I know.
So many.
When I went there, it was
buildings.
All bombed out. People are really having a hard time now. Complete like a metropolis. It's completely different. Yeah.
It's very urban.
Yeah. Wow.
So I'll just ask you to speak into the mic.
So the main thing is go right into the mic. Why don't you give me a hand signal if it's coming in fuzzy or loud or whatever.
That's good.
But I could just be very natural from here.
Yep, very natural.
All right, very good.
And great.
But you could go ahead and ask me anything. You probably have to edit out because
yeah, we're
if it's too general. But
mm-hmm.
There's some areas I could be very specific on too.
All right, let's just start talking about the contributions. Okay, no.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the things that contributed to a large number of Japanese-owned flower shops and gardeners emerging in the early 1900s. Why do you think so many Japanese wanted to get into gardening, and how did they become to be owners of flower shops at that time?
Well, a lot of it is very strategic because what the immigrants face, especially the immigrants from Japan, was the limitations on opportunities. And this is because of discriminatory laws. And one of the more serious ones was the alien land laws. And the alien land laws, which were passed in about 17 Western states, really targeted Asians. And at that time, the main immigrants from Asia were either from China or Japan. And the early success of the Japanese farmers in particular, I think, prompted a kind of fear of competition. And so what the alien land law said was that people who are not qualified for citizenship could not lease or buy land. And so the Japanese were primarily in agriculture, really affected. And the way they could keep on farming was actually rent or perhaps buy land in the name of their kids. But even when they rented land, because of discrimination, they were charged exorbitant prices compared to the rest of the people who might be renting land. And because they're limited in terms of how much space they could have, they had to be very strategic in terms of what kind of crops to grow and how to increase production. So it's no accident that many Japanese went into very intensive kind of agriculture. So horticulture was one of them. And also fruit growing, vegetable growing, and especially trying to be selective about areas where they could increase production and be close to the market. So you have a lot of urban area farming going on, small-scale farming. And so these factors do contribute to the choices people have made.
And are you familiar with the concentration of, like in California, where were people concentrating farming?
That's right.
Farming?
Yeah, I think the best example is both the Bay Area and Los Angeles. One striking thing about Los Angeles, people may not think of it, but first of all, California leads in agriculture production. And then the Central Valley of California is the prime area. It's if you take the 3,000 counties in America and rank them according to agriculture production, usually number 1, 2, 3 is California, Fresno, Kern, Tulare County. In fact, of the top 10, I would say 6 or 7 of them are California, pretty much Central Valley. But 60 years ago, the number one agriculture county in California was Los Angeles. Los Angeles was very productive, and the reason for its productivity was the ethnic farming. And primarily ethnic farming was Japanese. And it's all very small scale, and they produced crops that would really sell to the urban market. And so this accounts for, I think, the great concentration around this urban area, the Bay Area, especially in terms of the Southern California markets as well.
So talk about the economics a little more around the horticulture.
I'm
going to move this back a little.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you have a tremendous, the horticulture selection has to do with space also, because after all, one of the strategies was what kind of crops can people produce if they're limited in terms of space and also in terms of money and other resources. And so the selection of crops corn, wheat, completely out. You could have a couple hundred acres and you couldn't get the kind of income. But if you had 3 or 4 acres of strawberries or even a half acre of flower growing in a greenhouse, that increases your opportunity for income. All right. So that has a lot to do with the kind of intense concentration, but also a very selective kind of attention to rethinking about what the good market is. And I think the same can be said for gardening as well. Actually, the gardening was kind of an entry point, both at the early periods, but also post-war. After the Japanese came back from the camps, many of them really had very little to start with. And for a good number of them, the opportunities for farming were pretty much decimated because they had lost things, you know. And so the way to start was to use the skills in terms of what they knew, how to deal with plants and the land. And so city gardening became a very important kind of a starting point again. Now, in terms of my own personal experience, it's quite different because I grew up on the Indian reservation. And the reason why we were on this Indian reservation was because of the alien land laws. And the in the case of my family, we went to the Yakima Indian Reservation in eastern Washington, mainly because the Indians really came through for us. They rented land to the Japanese immigrants. There are 125 immigrant families in the Yakima Valley, right? The Yakima Valley is very famous now for the red delicious apples. But when the Japanese went in there in the early 1900s, it's pretty much all sagebrush country. And they cleared the area. And many of them were in truck farming. And again, I think to illustrate some of the strategies that were involved was not only was there discrimination in terms of renting or leasing land, but very difficult to get money. You need money to do anything. In other words, you have to get credit. The banks would not loan to the Japanese. So the Japanese started their own what we call rotating credit associations. And this is called tanomoshi in Japanese. And by the way, this kind of a rotating credit association is common among many Asian groups. Koreans have it, Chinese have it, Filipinos, Vietnamese. And the way it operates is that a group of 10 people who know each other very well will put money into the pot. And, you know, the customary pattern of banks is to demand collateral. Well, many immigrants don't have collateral. They don't have land. They don't have anything to put up. So the main collateral they used was personal honor. So because an honor was very valuable, because if you renege, you'd be ostracized by the group. But this is very valuable collateral. So this is another strategy to use if you are putting up a lot of discrimination. So these rotating credit associations enable people to really get moving. And going back to Los Angeles situation, in addition to many of the people choosing very intensive crops and so they could survive and do well, eventually the Japanese contributions to Los Angeles and California agriculture was such that they pretty much dominated also the marketing. So the Los Angeles produce market was really controlled by the Japanese. And this became a very important source for many practical considerations. In addition to having a trustworthy place where you could deal with people of your own culture, this became a very important source of borrowing, lending money too, as well. So this is how the ethnic community really pulled together. And it was because of trying to figure out how do you survive in a society where there might be many kinds of restrictions on what you could do.
And a lot of Japanese communities were formed. Talk about the role that the communities played for people. And, well, you did talk about the economic function and the social function, but if you want to say more about the functions that the Japanese communities had for individuals.
Well, you know, I think one of the more interesting contributions of ethnic groups in California farming, and particularly in the Japanese in this case, is that what they had been doing in the early part of the 20th century is very relevant to what's going on in the 21st century, all right? What's going on in the 21st century? There's a growing consciousness about health. There's also a growing consciousness about people getting quality products that are fresh. They also, people are more concerned about the energy situation. Because a lot of the products that are produced now travel 3,000 to 5,000 miles before they get to their destination. There's tremendous costs here. And so if you look at how the Japanese farmers were operating in California, there are very many practical lessons. First of all, because if you look at the Los Angeles County situation, many of the Japanese farmers were able to operate on a direct consumer-to-producer relationship because they sold, instead of going to the retailer, wholesaler-retailer chain, they sold directly to the consumer by putting up vegetable fruit stands at the farm. And so what does this do? If you have this kind of operation, first of all, economic is an advantage to the lot of population. The city people will come in, and they will pay a price lower than what they have to pay in the market. The farmer benefits because that farmer gets more than if he sold through a wholesaler retailer, all right? So there's that benefit. But the other thing is, if you buy locally, you can get fresh produce, and you get many local varieties. Today, if you look at the number of varieties, you go to the store and buy apples or whatever, there are very few varieties. We have maybe 500-600 different kinds of apples, for example, many kinds of peaches. Well, many of the very top quality type, very tasty kind of fruits are very susceptible to damage. They can't be shipped long distances. But if you produce locally and you buy there, you get very fresh local products. So you get freshness. The other thing is, because you're buying locally, you're not spending all that money on shipping. So you're saving money on energy. And fourthly, you're getting that kind of direct relationship, you know, the consumer and the producer. Not only that, you have an answer to all these kind of problems people are raising today. In fact, this is the whole idea behind both what we call community-supported agriculture, direct marketing, farmers market, and also natural, you know, organic kind of produce in a way. But the interesting, I think, observation to make here is how relevant all those practices were that were done 100 years ago, they're relevant today. So I think that's kind of the major contribution of the Japanese farming to California today.
And you talk more about your own personal experience and your family's in the agricultural.
Well, yeah, I think there's several things here. One is how the community survived. And before the war, it was pretty much, I was in an isolated community situation. It was pretty much all, I grew up in the Yakima Indian Reservation, and the only people I really knew were either other Japanese immigrants or the Indians. And when I first went to the school, I was really surprised to see people who are white. And I was very concerned because I was told that, when you get sick, you're white. You get white, okay? And so I said, God, what's all these white sick people doing here? And I asked my grandfather, what's the problem, And he told me, well, they're probably that way because they're not eating enough rice, all right? So I said, okay, I'll eat a lot of rice. So anyway, I grew up in that kind of an isolated situation. And I think this is true of many other rural communities. And these communities, the farming community, although they're spread out, they really had a very important social network, especially around the cultural festivals, especially around the community churches, whether they're what they call generically Christian or the Buddhist temples. And so my father was trained as a carpenter before he immigrated to America. And so he was asked to take over the construction of an annex to the Buddhist temple that was built on his reservation, all right? And so I remember how people came to help each other out. And in the case of my family, You know, we were farming about 80 acres, but my father was spending so much time building the temple annex that our fields really got neglected. And people, we couldn't figure out what we were growing, what kind of weeds were we growing, specializing in. And one day, 50 farmers showed up, and they completely cleared out the field for us. We were growing carrots at the time. You know, my parents are very grateful and appreciative of all the help. But the farmers gave us a look, you know, you've been doing a lot for us, and it's our turn to help you. And I think that's a kind of a spirit that enabled these communities to survive and work together. And I think it says a lot about community building and how people, you know, work together. But then when the war came, like many other Japanese families who are farming, they had to just pick up and go. And in our case, you know, we didn't own the land. We were just renting land. But I know other people who had property really hurt pretty badly. And so when we spent time in the camps, one of the offshoots of the camp is because of all those skills, many of these camps had their own farm plots. And I was in two camps, both in Har Mountain, Wyoming, and Northern Tule Lake, California. And in both these camps, the farms that were run by the inmates of the camps were enough, you know, produce food stuff for the entire camp. In the case of Tule Lake, they're very productive, and they sent the material to other camps as well. And so the skills were applied. But when the war was over, a lot of people start all over again. So in our case, we didn't go back to the Indian reservation. We came to California because we were in a Tule Lake camp in California, and we settled in the Bay Area. And after about a year working for the Southern Pacific Railroad, my father saw an item in the ethnic newspaper about a call for share farmers for Driscoll Strawberry Company in the Santa Clara Valley. And so he figured that families could go back to farming. And I remember my first reaction going to this little town called Madrone, where the strawberry Driscoll had an operation, about 50 different families all bunched together. And those houses looked just like the barracks I lived in the camp. And I thought, oh, it's back in camp again. And the way we operated was a 50-50 proposition, namely, Driscoll would supply the land, the supplies, the tractor and all, and the family supplied all the labor. And we also paid for the labor that we hired during the peak season. And then Driscoll had control over the marketing. So we really had no say in terms of how the produce was sold. And so we did this for about 4 years when the, you know, strawberry cycle ran out and decided to rent land on our own. And we were able to start up again. And we did that for about 4 or 5 years in a town of Coyote. And Coyote is even smaller than Madrone. Coyote's road sign said population 150 rather, okay? I'm the oldest of 13 kids. So that means our family either made up or contributed 10% of the town's population, all right? Coyote is now part of Silicon Valley, it's part of San Jose now. But I think what this shows is kind of the possibility of the agricultural ladder. Agricultural ladder means that in the American pattern in the past, a person might start as a laborer for some farmer, and then he saves up money, he starts renting land, and he saves up more money, he could buy his own land. Well, many of the families I knew in the Morgan Hill, Madrone, Coyote area worked as share farmers for Driscoll's. Then they were able to get out, either rent or buy land, and they settled down. And so the agricultural ladder was still possible. Today, I would say it's impossible. I meet a lot of young kids who want to learn this in farming because I teach at UC Davis, and it's very difficult for people to start off this way. They either have to inherit or they have to marry into some kind of family that already has all this land. But I think the experience of the Japanese is has a lot of lessons, because if you look over a 100-year period, we're talking about the changes in American society, of one that had tremendous discrimination against people of color, and then the impact of major forces like wars, and what does that do to people? And here we have a situation, and 60 years ago, we got this whole group targeted because of war, and they're put away. Today, where are we? 2005, we got the same situation in the Middle East, and the people of the Middle East are also being affected in the same way the Japanese were. So I think there's a lot of lessons. We're not just talking about agriculture. We're talking about community, and we're talking about opportunity and what kind of possibilities there are for people who come to California, who come to America. So I think using agriculture and the Japanese experience as a starting point, there are many other kind of discussions that are possible and that are very important here.
Right, definitely. And for example, the agricultural situation before World War II in California was the majority controlled by Japanese farmers and Japanese communities. And then Executive Order 9066 came down, mm-hmm. and talk about the impact that that had as a whole on the agriculture of California.
Well, yeah, you know, to give you an idea how productive Japanese were in California, this goes back to the time of the First World War, about 1918, and the California agriculture production was about maybe $500 million, $523 million. And yet, of that, though, the Japanese farmers accounted for over $53 million. So that's about 10%. And yet, they were a very small part of the farming population. And I would say that even in terms of the amount of land that they occupied, they had maybe only about 3 or 4%. Now, the reason, one more thing to mention about strategy they used. The reason why the Japanese were able to succeed was their approach to certain types of crops to produce, but they also figured out how to increase production on a limited land they could have. And so two things they did. They irrigated and they used fertilizers. And so even though the Japanese may have rented a very small proportion of the California agricultural land, they rented about maybe 10-15% of the irrigated land in California. So this is part of this thinking. You know, how do you survive? And so I think all these kinds of examples do have a lot of lessons in terms of what do people do. Farming is more than just skills and raising food. You have to know how to borrow money. You have to know how to market. You also have to know how to work together. And so another very important element of the Japanese farming was a role of cooperatives. So by having cooperatives, people could pool their energy and they could also benefit from economies of scale. And so if you have a group of maybe 50 farmers, they could have a better deal if they want to buy supplies, fertilizer, and so on. I would say in the case of my own family raising strawberries, they were part of the Nature Right Co-op Association. And one of the benefits of the Nature Ripe Association was how to deal with the market. See, if you're just growing fresh strawberries and you sell only to the wholesale or retail market, you're at the mercy of the market. And what happens in strawberry growing is that if a strawberry comes out early, you get a very good price. But as the season develops, you get more and more strawberries. When that happens, everybody's producing strawberry, so the market price goes way down. So you're gonna really hurt. Well, the way the Nature Ripe Association helped its members was they bought a freezer. Once you got a freezer, then you have all the strawberries stashed away, and you can produce other kind of products. You call them value-added, products in a way. And so instead of just fresh strawberries, now you have strawberries you can freeze, and you sell frozen strawberries, and you also have strawberries for jam, for ice cream, and you have all these other kind of commodities you could produce. And so this is the strength and advantage of having cooperative associations. So I think all of these are very valuable ideas, you know, in terms of thinking of farming not just as an individual effort, but as a community effort.
And then when all that was taken away, when internment happened. What happened to the market at the time of the 9066?
Well, there's a lot of ironies here, too. Not only were the Japanese farmers producing, but these people are also working on their own land. They provide the labor as well. I mean, that's the definition of a family farm. Okay. The you know, what's the difference between a family farm and a large-scale corporate farm? Well, you know, there's kind of three main aspects to farm operation. You have to provide the labor. You have to provide the management, you know, in terms of if you hire people. But you also have this whole thing about ownership and being responsible for the economy part. Well, if you have if you go to a large corporate farm, these three areas are done by three different kinds of people. The laborers are very different from the farm owner, the manager, who are very different from the owners, all right? But in a family farm, the family is responsible for all three. They have responsibility for the property and the materials. They have to run things, and they also have to work. So that's the definition of a family farm. And so I think the kinds of work that's being done pretty much by the Japanese farming experience was the American family farm model.
And what happened to the economy when...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's the...
That's right. Going back to that, the... one of the things in the camps was there was a shortage of labor, farm labor everywhere. And many places were letting kids out of high school early and all. And so I remember in the Heart Mountain camp, all the young people were called to harvest sugar beets. And so this is how my grandfather and my aunt, they were able to leave camp on what they call temporary leave. They had to come back to the concentration camp. But they were allowed to go out for 2 or 3 months to help out farms in Idaho, Montana, and so on.
That's ridiculous. You have to, first people own the land, and they're farming it, and the whole agricultural economy is owned by the Japanese in America. And then they get interned.
Yeah.
And then the economy probably suffered greatly, but then they had to outsource from the camps. That's
yeah, well, there are many people involved in farming here. I wouldn't say the Japanese control the farming so much, but there are enough examples in California, Oregon, and Washington where they were concentrated. And I think the contributions became even more apparent when you know, local communities were affected in this kind of way. I would say that you know, going back to the big picture, in terms of what have you learned in 100 years of ethnic farming in California, there's so many ways of looking at this in terms of the ideas and strategies that were used, how to deal with discrimination, what happens there because of big catastrophes like war and internment, what do you do to get resettled back, what kind of contributions can people make in terms of the efforts going on now in terms of the public's quest for, you know, quality food that's healthy and fresh. And I think we have a lot to learn from the ethnic experience. And I will say one of the interesting kind of follow-ups today is that many Japanese have left farming, all right? And yet people are still producing strawberries on a small scale as an example. And who's doing the work? It's the refugees from Southeast Asia, because if you go to Fresno County, there must be at least 800 families from Laos, either Hmong or Laotians, who are doing the farming, and the farming is really 2 to 5 acre strawberry farms.
And talk about the intergenerational aspect of horticulture and agricultural business, the ise, passing it down, and yeah.
Okay, well, I'll give you an example of just, again, my own personal example of experience in the state of Washington. I was involved in a reunion of people who lived on this reservation, and we brought everybody back because people had been scattered everywhere. And we had these, you know, these newsprint all over the hotel wall, and I asked everybody to put down their, go to the family name, and because I had a directory for written in the 30s, we put all these names on that and the name of the family and all the siblings. But we also wanted to put down who did he get married to and how many who are the kids and what's the occupation of all these people. And what was kind of very revealing was that I would say of the 125 families, good, maybe 100 of them were farming. Other people are small merchants and so on. But then if you look at the who are they now, first of all, many people were scattered everywhere. They're no longer concentrating in these small communities. They're in Chicago, New York, or whatever it might be. The other thing was the names had all changed. Before, when I was growing up, everybody had Japanese names. But now, you know, people call Michelle, Brian, all that, all right? So the names change. But the occupation is, I think, that's most revealing. I would say great proportion of people are no longer in farming. There's a tremendous number of people, Japanese-American third generation, who are in different kind of professional work. And so there's been a big shift intergenerationally. Of those who stayed in farming, though, the major kind of shift I see is that the economy has had its big role in terms of weeding people out. So the people who survive now have to get big. So you have large-scale farms by those who have left, who have remained behind. I might make one more comment about the contribution of the Japanese American farms, and this is internationally, because after the war, you know, Japan was devastated, and so the Japanese are trying to rebuild their society, and one of the things they want to build their agriculture up again, so they start sending farmers to learn about farming American style. And many of the initial programs, this was put together by the University of California and the Farm Bureau, and they got many of the Japanese American farms to be hosts to these trainees from Japan. And they've done this since, you know, 1946 or so. It's still going on. And so I would say that the people who worked on these Japanese American farms, they went back to Japan, and they had a big impact in terms of how Japanese agriculture has developed as well. These Japanese trainees who came to the farms learned about vegetable, fruit growing and all. But now the Japanese are interested in other things. They want to, you know, run dairy farms or how to run cattle because of meat consumption and all. So now these Japanese trainees go all over America. They go to Wisconsin, et cetera. And there are fewer Japanese American farms too. But I would say that's an interesting thing to examine. What's the relationship between ethnic farmers and other countries? Because, and in terms of the Japanese American farms in California, not only was the Japanese coming, but Brazilian Japanese are also coming to get trained here, and they go back to Brazil. And so I know that if you look at California farms, we have many different kinds of ethnic groups involved. You know, East Indians growing peaches in the Yuba City sort of area. If you look at the Central Valley, look at the names or Croatian, Sicilian names. You have a whole group of Azorians who are involved in the dairy industry. So I think you could take this discussion of the on the Japanese contribution and expand it to many other ethnic groups and the kind of role they had in building up California agriculture.
And I have two more questions. Going back to the intergenerational aspect, why do you think that it's not getting passed down from generation to generation as much? Why aren't the third generation sensei?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they not deciding to continue farming?
Well, I think it's a pretty natural kind of evolution of societal choices, all right? Farming is hard work. It's very demanding. You have to stand at all the time. But also we have educational forces and we have media forces to work. And people get new kinds of ideas. And also many parents would like to see their kids go beyond what they're doing. And they see farming as a way to keep the family together. But now, you know, the world is changing. American society is definitely changing. And when people get educated, they get new kind of ideas. So all of this contributes to the fact that you're not going to have people staying in farming. They're going to do other things. In fact, if you look at the entire picture of farming in America, we have a very small percent of people now who are actually farming. And even those who stay in farming are not relying on agriculture as their main source of income. They're also holding other kinds of jobs. And we find this happening all over the world. So that's definitely a factor. And so you're going to get this kind of intergenerational change. The other part is, what's going to replenish then the source of farming? And we do find young people, some interested. But as I mentioned before, there are major barriers now for people starting up. The reason why people have gone into farming all over the world is because this is more or less kind of natural, easy, obvious thing to do. There's land there, you have to eat, you have to put all your energy into producing food. But now, as technology developed, it became much more efficient to free up people to do other things. And we have technological advancements in agriculture now that has really freed people up. And so all of these factors, I think, contribute to intergenerational changes.
And why didn't you want to do farming?
Well, for several reasons. One is that I had this opportunity to go to school, and but I kept an interest in farming. That's just why I went into rural sociology, and I do rural community development. And I would say of the 13 of us in the family, only one has stayed in agriculture-related work. They run a nursery. They raise flowers in Morgan Hill. And I look at this as a pattern for many other of the peers that I grew up with. That we were all farm kids. But once we left high school and had a chance to go to college, new kinds of jobs, then it seems that, we were challenged to take on these new kind of opportunities. And I think this is happening to many other people, too.
And that's your sister who's in the flower industry?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to say anything about
Yeah,
that?
I could say that it's very tough. And I would say there's a lot of ironies, again, because they grow carnations, but they can't compete because carnations grow in Colombia, all right? So the Colombian, South American markets, they rose, roses or carnations or whatever, are now competing against Americans, the flower growers. So in the case of my family, in order for my sister to survive, they set up a flower shop. And so they concentrate, I would say they spend as much, if not more, of their efforts in creating bouquets for all the different holidays. And not only that, they start branching out to very specialty crops. They grow watercress and mint. And so the watercress is a very special kind of a commodity. And I would say their income from watercress and the mint and the flower shop offsets all the losses from the carnations. And so if you only had carnation, they would go broke. And so it's kind of a lost proposition. And I think this is another example of going just paying, if you start looking at agriculture in any kind of way, it's asking more than how good a farmer is, but what are they up against? And we're talking about international competition. We're talking about the very diverse market. We're talking about, again, strategic thinking. You start looking for niche crops. You look for crops that appeal to a certain kind of market. I would say many ethnic farmers now, the Asians in particular, can operate on small scale because there's a huge Asian market now. I mean, I know farmers in the Fresno area just grow 2 acres of Japanese eggplants, all right? Or you look at the Korean population or the Chinese population, Southeast Asia, they have very specialty Asian vegetables. And the interesting thing is that the American public at large is also picking up on this. So this provides a certain kind of niche. However, don't put it past big corporations to take over this market too. And this will, again, affect the smaller scale family farmers.
So keeping it local.
Yeah.
Great. I think that's all the questions that I have, unless you want to add anything else.
No, this is fine.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay,
that was good. Almost an hour. It's a little less than an hour. So.
Okay, that's great. Okay.
Thank you. You
so,
gave a lot of information.
What kind of a program do you have a focus on just on ethnic farming? I know you talked to Wayne and several other people.
Yeah.
So what do you have about maybe 20 minutes or 30 minutes you could put together or what?
Well, this is a this is the production. It's not for KPFA. It's for NPR, this specific project. It's 8 1-hour series.
Wow, my God. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so this tells you all about it.
That's great.
You're going to be part of the Frontier Asians.
Okay, very good.
My case is going to be in that.
Oh.
The 1-hour series.
And when is this going to start appearing?
It's going to be in
May. How many of these have you done already?
Well, I have 3 stories.
Uh-huh.
Japanese agricultural contributions,
Amerasian identity,
yeah,
which I'm Amerasian. And then the third one is military brides.
Oh, is that right?
Military brides.
Wow, very good.
They're different, but.
And then once you finish this, does it go to other public radio stations as well?
I see. They'll play on NPR all across.
How many NPR outlets are there now?
I'm not sure, because KPFA is not NPR, so this is my first experience with NPR.
I see.
But I'll definitely keep you informed, and actually you're supposed to sign a release form.
Okay, sure.
I don't have it, but maybe you can write it.
Oh, yeah, you could send it to me or whatever, you know.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
Yeah, that's very good.
And I'll also send you a copy of the finished piece.
Okay, very good. That's
you know
great.
I've been trying to get a hold of is Mas Masumoto.
Yeah, he's very difficult. He used to be one of my students, and he's now very involved with James Irvine. He's on the board of James Irvine Foundation, and he's also with the California Council of Humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And because of his book, he goes around. This is kind of off season. He goes around talk shows and all that. That's why he's. But you know, he does have an email.
I sent him an email, and he said, "I'm very busy."
That's right. Yeah, that's probably understandable. His daughter's right here at Berkeley.
Really?
Yeah, I may want to talk to her.
What's her name? Do you know?
Let me see what her name is now. I think it starts with a K. You can find out. You just go to the webpage and you'll find it. And both he and his wife were in the graduate program that I started at Davis.
Said you should talk to me.
So,
and Codo Farms, do you think Codo Farms are accessible?
Here's a funny story about Codo Farms, too. They were getting so many visitors, they finally stopped putting a microphone on the farm. And so people talk into that. They couldn't afford time anymore. And then one of the brothers died. The person that was really interested was the father. The father was very, very PR oriented. He felt it was his obligation to also talk to other people, especially Japanese. Mm-hmm. So Japanese farmers would come by the busload.
Oh, wow.
And now the last guy, because I had a dealing with him, I had these farmers from the prefecture where he came from Fukushima prefecture,
mm-hmm.
and. In fact, it came from the same village where the father came from. So I asked Ed, you know, hey, look, is it possible for you to meet these people? And he was very resistant, and finally I had to go see him.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And but he's the only one running it now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's retired, so I don't know who's taking over.
What's that guy's name, Ed?
What's that?
Ed is?
Ed Koda. He's the son of the original Koda. There are two brothers. It's called Koda Brother Farms.
Yeah.
But one of them died, so
mm-hmm.
it's down to him. And
he probably wouldn't want to talk to me. Huh?
Well, I think you have to approach him in different ways. He has a daughter-in-law who is the daughter of the other brother who died. But, you know, she's married to Gary Snyder. Very interesting. So Carol, her name is Carol. I don't know how she might be accessible. I mean, she could certainly comment on, growing up there and what it's like and so on. But I think that's pretty interesting because, they're in a very unusual part of California. Most rice growing in the north, but they're in Merced County, and it's kind of unusual why they're even there. But his rice brand is famous all over Japan, too.
Really?
Yeah, Kokoho rice, Kokoho rolls. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, you're welcome.
Do you have a busy day today?
I have to meet with the former program officer, Irvine Foundation, because I run this Central Valley Partnership for Citizenship. Uh-huh. I work with the immigrants. And so he and I are getting together, and then Food First is another big, about that.
Yeah.
I'm the chairman of the board, so I have to kind of deal with the staff right now.
You're busy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking time out for me.
What's that again?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, let me see.
Can you push it back?
I have to.